I'm Christopher Leighton. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This one is with first novelist Paul Harding about the book that flew in over the transom and took me by storm. It's called Tinkers, as in itinerant country peddlers. It's called Tinkers, as in itinerant country peddlers. Paul Harding is an ex-rock drummer who writes in search of the rhythm of words, of time, and generations. He's also a self-taught modern New England transcendentalist out of the Thoreau and Emerson school, who read his way into an original inner life. Tinkers is about fathers dying, thinking about their sons and their fathers. Paul Harding, I think I've read your book Tinkers three times since the weekend, and I'm not going to get over it. This is what Henry James spoke of, fiction that has more life in it than life itself. How did you do it? What's this about?
That's a good question. I don't know if I can reproduce the experience of how I did it. I worked on it for a long time, sort of on you know, nights and weekends, as it were, during teaching stints at Harvard and raising two young sons with my wife. And I thought of it as almost like having a canvas of a large painting kind of up in the back room for years, and you just sort of keep going back to it and sort of painting over it and then scraping paint off, where over time things may come and go, but in the end the kind of the cumulative work is consistent with itself.
This book is a joy to pick up on any page. That's sort of the mystery, and then to read backwards. There are fragments in it. We'll come to the whole mystery of the structure. The story, so to speak, is about a man dying, a New England guy named George Washington Crosby, and he's reliving his father's life as he dies. His father was hugely preoccupied with his father's life. One has the sense that we're talking about a chain of conversation going back to Adam.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly was interested in a kind of familial consciousness, the idea that the consciousness is very porous, and that their identities are sort of a familial consciousness in the way that sometimes you have, you know, people write about entire towns. This is sort of, you know, the history of the of this kind of, in this case, patrilineal kind of consciousness. And I thought of that. I thought of as you go down through the generations. I thought, you know, the most remote generation is a guy who's was a Methodist minister in Maine in the 19th century, and somebody pointed out to me the other day that he doesn't have a name, and I had never even thought of that, but I always thought of that. So whenever I worked on that section of the book, I thought, well, this is the Old Testament. This is like back to the begats. You know, this is sort of the oldest kind of, you know, the oldest stories, you know, and just that idea that at a certain point, even when you think of your own family, at a certain point, there's a certain point beyond which you just don't know anything anymore. There are no names anymore. There are ghosts. There's rumors, and yet at the same time, you have members of your family saying, so there are family resemblances that are, you know, people recall and, you know, see in you of generations that, you know, you'll never have any direct contact with. So I just like that. I mean, you know, my maternal grandparents were both from northern Maine, and I was fascinated while I was growing up by all of their stories about northern Maine. But for some reason, it was very difficult to get them to elaborate on those stories. And I don't know, they were very, very impoverished, and I think they had very difficult lives. And I think that they always had the attitude that you know, they made it out of the woods, and that was then, and this is now. And almost the kind of attitude that I feel like I know friends of mine who have parents who immigrated, you know, and they sort of like don't teach them the language from the old country, and that's sort of like, now we're Americans, this kind of thing. And so I was just always fascinated with, for example, you know, to the extent that I could get my grandmother to remember her grandfather, put me in direct contact with the Civil War. Her grandfather was a nurse in the Union Army with Walt Whitman. And so I love that kind of foreshortening of time. That you can sort of almost circumvent time and be in the same room with these people in some ways, as you say, the different generations sort of channeling previous generations.
The central image in the title of Tinkers, these men are peddlers. There's all kinds of stuff, merchandise and clocks and details and weather and landscape. There's also a whole lot of humor. Would you give us that scene where Howard, the peddler with a cart, is introducing a new brand of soap?
Certainly. The stubbornness of some of the country women with whom Howard came into contact on his daily rounds cultivated in him, he believed, or would have believed, had he ever consciously thought about the matter, an unshakable reasoning patience. When the soap company discontinued its old detergent for a new formula and changed the design on the box the soap came in, Howard had to endure debates he would have quickly conceded were his adversaries not paying customers. "Where's the soap?" "This is the soap. The box is different." "Yes, they changed it." "What was wrong with the old box?" "Nothing." "Why'd they change it?" "Because the soap is better." "The soap is different?" "Better." "Nothing wrong with the old soap." "Of course not, but this is better." "Nothing wrong with the old soap. How can it be better?" "Well, it cleans better. Cleaned fine before. This cleans better and faster." "Well, I'll just take a box of the normal soap." "This is the normal soap now." "I can't get my normal soap?" "This is the normal soap. I guarantee it." "Well, I don't like to try a new soap." "It's not new." "Just as you say, Mr. Crosby, just as you say." "Well, ma'am, I need another penny." "Another penny? For what?" "The soap is a penny more now that it's better." "I have to pay a penny more for different soap in a blue box? I'll just take a box of my normal soap."
There's a certain main humor here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I sort of get that from my grandfather, and he used to have all the old Bert and I records, and it's that Down East kind of humor.
Remind me. We used to know them all.
Oh, boy, there's so many of them, and it's the kind of humor where, you know, if you like it, you think it's the funniest stuff you've ever heard, and if you don't like it, it seems just sort of inscrutable and sort of intractable. But,
I think of that guy who called out, the guy spinning his wheels in the mud. And somebody calls out on the road, are you stuck? And he says, well, I would be if I was going anywhere.
Right, exactly. There's always the couple comes to a fork in the road, and there's the old woman sort of standing there, and they say, well, does it matter which road, which direction we take to Bangor? And she says, not to me, it don't. You know, they stop and the woman's in the road and they stop and they say, do you know how to get to Bangor? And she says, nope. So they drive along, and the wife sees her flagging them back down in the rearview mirror. So they stop and they back up, and she goes back, and she's brought her husband out of the cornfield, a potato field, it would be in Maine. And she says, you know, this is my husband, Eustace, and he don't know neither. You know, just that sort of... And this is how my grandmother, this is sort of my maternal, she would have talked like that. I don't like to try a normal soap. You know, it's just sort of the strangest syntax and the strangest, you know, strangest kind of intractability.
At the center of the story, Paul, is Howard, a very beautiful, dark character. He's epileptic. He's always in danger of the sort of fit that would make him bite his tongue out. He has a troubled family in certain ways, and yet he's hugely sympathetic. He's out there with his cart. There's a passage I wish you'd read where he cultivates a hermit way back in the woods, a man who, by reputation, had gone to Bowdoin College as a classmate with Nathaniel Hawthorne. But the people who repeat the rumors say, but, you know, it'd have to be 120 years old if that were true. Would you just read, it's a beautiful end of a short story, where describing these two men who meet year after year.
Sure. The men had exchanged few words during the first few years of this spring ritual, which is the ritual of Howard bringing this hermit Gilbert his supplies on a sort of every year in the spring. The men had exchanged few words during the first few years of this spring ritual, and these only to refine the order of Gilbert's supplies. One year he said, more needles. Another year he said, no more tea, coffee now. Once the list had been refined and finally established, the two men no longer spoke at all. For the past 7 years, neither man had uttered a single word to the other. The last year Howard met Gilbert in the woods, though, the men spoke. When he came upon the hermit, he saw that the man's left cheek was as swollen and as shiny as a ripe apple. Gilbert shuffled his feet and stared at the ground and held his hand against the cheek. Even the flies, Gilbert is attended by a loyal group of flies, because he's so pungent, even the flies were solicitous of their sponsor's pain and seemed to buzz more gingerly about him. Howard cocked his head in a silent question. Gilbert whispered, "Tooth." Howard could not imagine that this old husk of a man, this recluse, who seemed not much more than a sour hank of hair and rags, had a tooth left in his head to ache. Nevertheless, it was true. Stepping closer, Gilbert opened his mouth, and Howard, squinting to get a good look, saw in that dank, ruined purple cavern, stuck way in the back of an otherwise empty levee of gums, a single black tooth planted in a swollen and bright red throne of flesh. A breeze caught the hermit's breath, and Howard gasped and saw visions of slaughterhouses and dead pets under porches. "Tooth," the hermit said again and pointed to his mouth. "Oh, yes, awful thing," Howard said and smiled in sympathy. The hermit said, "No, tooth," and continued pointing. Howard realized that the poor afflicted man wanted him to take the tooth out. "Oh, no, no," he said, I have no idea." Gilbert cut him off. "No, tooth," he squeaked, an octave higher than before. "But I haven't any..." Again, the hermit cut him off, shooing him back toward where his wagon stood, 3 miles away at the Comfort Camp Club cabin. Howard returned 2.5 hours later with a small flask of corn whiskey from Potts Mountainside Still and a pair of long-handled pliers he used when he had to solder small pieces of tin to leaky pots. At first, Gilbert refused any liquor, but when Howard grabbed the tooth with the pliers, the old man passed out. Howard dashed a handful of cold river water on Gilbert's face. The hermit came to and motioned for the whiskey, which he drank in a single draft, then passed out again from the alcohol on the bedeviled tooth. Another splash of water revived Gilbert, and the two men sat for a time, watching a pair of sparrows chase a crow above the fir trees on the other side of the river. The river was high after an early, fast melt and loud. Voices seemed to mingle in the water as if there were a race of men who dwelled among the rapids. When Gilbert began to list and recite Virgil, Howard reached into the hermit's mouth with the pliers, grabbed the fetid tooth, and pulled with all of his strength. The tooth did not budge. Howard let go. Gilbert looked baffled for a moment and then passed out again, flat on his back, the flies neatly following him from upright to laid out. Howard was convinced at first that his customer was dead, but a damp whistle from the hermit's fly-rimmed nose indicated that he could still be counted among the relatively quick. The old man's mouth hung wide open. Howard straddled his shoulders and grabbed the tooth with the pliers. When he finally succeeded in excavating the tooth, Gilbert's face and beard were covered in blood. Another splash of river water revived the patient. When he saw Howard standing before him with the gory pliers in one hand and a tooth extraordinarily long of root in the other, Gilbert fainted. 2 weeks later, Buddy the dog's barking wakened Howard. He rose from the bed and went to the kitchen door to see if there was a bear or a stray cow in the yard. Placed on the doorstep was a package wrapped in greasy, foul-smelling leather and tied with twine, which Howard recognized as the type he sold. Standing in the moonlight, he untied the twine and unfolded the leather. Beneath the leather was a layer of red velvet. Howard opened the velvet, and there, looking as new as the day it was printed, the pages uncut, was a copy of The Scarlet Letter. Howard opened the book. Inscribed on the title page were the words, "To Hick Gilbert. Here is to the shared memories of young men in the prime of their journeys. Yours always in faith and brotherly friendship, Nathaniel Hawthorne, 1852.
I couldn't believe it when I first read it. I felt Hawthorne had sprung into the room with Emerson and Thoreau and Walt Whitman, maybe, and Melville, too. I mean, it's a kind of epiphany of those transcendentalists in our world again.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think I certainly those are the sort of the patron saints of the you know of the book and of my writing and of my brain. You know, I just feel like, I don't know, sometimes I can get cranky about, you know, when people bring up Emerson and Thoreau, because they're writers that are, that a lot of people act as if, you know, we've read them and we all sort of have them down, and so they have their little reputations that you can sort of, you know, summarize in 8 words or less, and when you go back to them, and particularly Emerson, I think Emerson is just like the great American writer, and his thinking is, there's such an immediacy to it, and the issues of philosophy, religion, even just consciousness, just being in time, as it were, and what they thought about them are still relevant now. You know, these are these sort of eternal questions. You know, no matter what you think about evolution or science or technology, these are the questions that are still as immediate, at least to this thinker, as they ever were. And few people tackled them with thought.
What is that question that fascinates us so? It's more than the self, although that's part of it. It's the prose of soulfulness somehow that never goes away.
Right. Yeah. It's self-awareness or self-consciousness. You know, the that kind of paradoxical experience of, you know, subjectively being able to confirm the existence of the self, but then you know the self is always just a, you know, an inch beyond your reach. So it's this strange, you know, kind of, you know, the self sort of persists in this miraculous way, and yet seems other.
Self-consciousness, also the title of John Updike's series of introspections, not quite an autobiography.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, and I think you get all of this sort of stuff too with Emerson. Clearly comes out of you know, the sort of Calvinist, the Reformation, the tradition of Reformation, and, you know, thinking, and you know, I'm very, very fond of that tradition. You know, the American lineage of that is, you know, Jonathan Edwards being the sort of ground zero for that, and the Great Awakening, and you can even trace it back to Tyndall, at least in the English, you know, in its English stripe or lineage. And him dying to bring, you know, English translations of the Bible, this idea that that literacy and you know, you know your own direct confrontation with your own experience, with your own lived experience, is the source for authenticity. Mm-hmm. You know, and this idea that that more and more, you know, I'm sort of, you know, sort of pessimistic about these sort of things, but, you know, just more and more, you don't have the authority to describe your own experience. And I think the Reformed thinking at its best is cut out the middleman, cut out the middleman, and see it for yourself, think it for yourself. No received opinion, no acculturated thinking. I mean, these things are inevitable, but I mean, the idea of you always have to look again. You know, and there's a dynamism to that that's very beautiful, the idea that it might have changed since you last looked at it. You know.
Paul Harding, for the reader, the pleasure is to hear all of this springing forth anew in a young man in New England and to think, holy mackerel, this tradition is real. It lives. It has a future.
Well, I don't, it's interesting. I think that it's, I don't know. In some sense, I feel like it's sort of eccentric, and it seems like retrograde or something. It's not very fashionable. You know. I mean,
well, you'll make it fashionable. But the question in my mind is, who are you after all? How did this happen?
There's the question. I don't, you know, sort of. I mean, I mean,
give us the dog tag. The basics.
Yeah, like, you know, I grew up on the North Shore of Boston in a little town called Wenham. And it has its traditions, and certainly there's always, you know, these sort of
more horses than people. We thought growing up.
Yeah, like I said, I always say that I grew up on the wrong side of the polo field. You know, my grandparents were sort of teachers and postal clerks and stuff like that. But it was a very sort of Tony existence. But really, for me, you know, the landscape always laid claim to me in a way that. You know, I just really just sort of circumstantially spent a lot of time knocking around in the woods, and, you know, in Wenham and all around there, all sorts of people left all sorts of very, very beautiful land to the Audubon Society. So it's as simple as that there's just a lot of really beautiful woods with picturesque little streams and creeks and ponds and, you know, critters and stuff to knock around in. And so from the earliest time I can remember, there's just this landscape. It's just been present. And so it's interesting to me, because, I mean, I suppose it was just so so primal to me that I didn't, that if it wasn't sort of baked into my cells, I may have actually made the choice to not pursue that tradition because it seemed so well, you know, the path was so well trodden that you think, oh God, well, you know, after Thoreau and Emerson and Cheever and all and Updike and all these guys, who would, you know, how could you possibly go back to the same stomping grounds and come up with new stuff? And of course you can. And I think that's even that learning that is a very Emersonian sort of thing. That sort of I think in Self-Reliance and all these things, he's very against traveling. I like to travel a lot, but just this idea of, even as when you talk about it in terms of a writer finding your subject, it's just sort of there it was right there all right along, that sort of thing.
Thoreau would have encouraged you. He'd say, you're as great a man as Homer, just get busy.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that's it's just really funny. You know, everybody sort of laments, where did Melville go, and where all these people, you know, there's nothing different, you know, about people now than, you know, so you can still sort of unabashedly sort of shoot for art, high art, you know.
What was the course of your own discovery of writing, and what did you try before that?
I don't know. I have a strange experience, which I think, I think it's common too, which is, you know, I thought I was considered in my family the writer long before I ever wrote. And I think partially it's because I always read. I was always a reader. I majored in English sort of half-heartedly at UMass Amherst. It took me 6 years to sort of get out with a lousy GPA. Still, again, was always reading books. Was a musician for a long time, played drums for many years, and was a professional musician for a number of years. After I graduated from undergraduate, I just spent a lot of time touring around North America and Europe in the back of a van, sort of playing very, very, you know, hard rock and a power trio, and sort of did a lot of that. And then on a break from touring once, I just knew that I had some time on my hands, and just decided to sort of, I mean, I guess the first time I wrote a story, at least my conscious thought was, it's time to sort of answer back. You know, I'd been doing so much reading and just thought, you know, I want to actually get into the conversation, you know, start, just sort of answer back with my own story. And at the time, I remember very, very explicitly, I was sort of, you know, deep in the reading and rereading of Thomas Mann and Carlos Fuentes. You know, and Carlos Fuentes' novel Terra Nostra was the first, in the middle of that, just remember putting it down one day and just thinking, this is what I want to do. Because that book in particular, it's just the entire world is in it, and all of history is in it. And what he does with time, and, you know, doubles back on time and the cycles of history and all this. And I think Thomas Mann does that as well. But I just was just so fascinated with that, that I just, you know, finally put pen to the paper. And then just had the very, very fortunate experience of, you know, I had a summer off, again, wasn't touring with the band, and I just kind of randomly signed up for a class at the New York Summer Writers Institute, which is at Skidmore College, a thing that a guy named Bob Boyers runs, and William Kennedy started it years ago.
That took guts, right?
I guess so. It was sort of, you know, ignorance, you know, sort of the innocent, sort of just wandering into this class, and just by the luck of the draw, my teacher was Marilyn Robinson, and it was just one of those experiences where within 10 minutes of her walking in the room, I just said, you know, where do I sign? Who do I sign the check to? Just
wow, this is Gilead housekeeping.
Now home, right. And at the time, she had just written Housekeeping. She was in the middle of that famous, you know, 25 years in between her first and second novel. But she was just she was just so sublime and just so magnificent and learned and gracious and dignified and just such a wonderful person. And I just thought, well, if this is what you get, you know, if you conduct your life by thinking about writing and doing this, this is what I want. So I wrote a couple of stories, found out that she taught at the University of Iowa at the Writer's Workshop there. Had no idea of that program's reputation. So again, that was sort of ignorant. I just sort of said, the University of Iowa, I should be able to get, you know, I should be able to do that. And so I just, you know, sent off an application the next year, and who, you know, God bless Frank Conroy, the director then. I got in, you know, and was able to study with Marilyn Robinson for a year. I was lucky. She was not there for a year, but while she was gone, an English novelist named Barry Unsworth was there. So I got to study with him, which was amazing. And then the other person that really just knocked my socks off there, and just another person who every time I see her, she makes me happy that I'm a writer, is Elizabeth McCracken, who's just
We love Elizabeth McCracken.
Yeah. She's just.
This is fascinating. I knew because Marilyn Robinson blurbed your book on the cover that there was a connection there. I also felt, reading your book, it sounds something like Gilead and Home. Here is a person thinking deeply through the history of a family. Father, what was that about? It also reminds me of Siri Hustvedt, who had taught at Iowa, who writes about her father uses his diaries of war experience in her novel about the sadness of an American. But then I thought, what's going on here? Tell me it's not a formula, that the Iowa process is about reconstructing a family narrative.
Yeah.
Or family consciousness.
No, I would say it's not. I mean, I don't know. I think this is, you know, this is the sort of perennial debate that comes up. And, you know, with Iowa, but also with just workshop fiction, there's always that danger of sort of the cookie cutter sort of thing. And I just think that kind of shortcut is always there for, but I think in the case of Marilyn Robinson, it wasn't so much an experience of feeling like I was being told new things. It was the experience of recognition, as she said things, you know, not unlike some of the best experiences reading, which is when you have that amazing kind of epiphanic moment where you simultaneously recognize that something is true, and that you've always known it to be true, but that you've never seen it precipitated into language, you know? And she can sort of extemporize verbally on that level of thought and of prose. And she's, she, you know, in her, I mean, she's very much a lover of the transcendentalists, you know? So, my love for them pre-existed meeting her, so I felt like it was kind of a kindred spirit sort of thing. But just to see somebody, you know, sort of alive and well, you know, thriving off of these sources is just.
Did you learn theology, Paul, from that crowd?
I learned it because I valued Marilyn Robinson's as a teacher, and then increasingly as just a friend, you know. And realized that, you know, if I was going to break bread with her, I should have my theological chops together. I mean, I grew up, I think I was a sort of very, you know, statistically kind of run-of-the-mill, middle-class, white boy atheist, you know, charging around with my copy of Nietzsche, you know, sort of making hay out of that kind of easy kind of contempt for religious thinking that's sort of, you know, that's in the air these days. And it just occurred to me one day that, you know, a lot of the thinkers, and particularly, you know, Marilyn Robinson, right, you know, sort of in the room, the people that I admire most were some profoundly religious people. So I figured I may as well look into the best that theology has to offer, just to sort of at least confirm my own skepticism about it. And, you know, 7 or 8 years later, several thousand pages of Karl Barth and John Calvin and that whole crew later, they still just lay claim, the deepest claim to my attention. I mean, it's just so beautiful aesthetically, prose-wise, philosophically, narrative-wise, cosmologically, that, you know, it's just...
Emotionally, too, by the end?
Yeah, sure, absolutely, absolutely. It just resonates. So, and the thinking, except, you know, Karl Barth's Church Dogmatics is, you know, 9,000 pages of, you know, sustained cosmological narrative, and it's so consistent with itself. Just on the level of prose and of thinking, it's just some of the best. You know, it's one of the most beautiful human artifacts that I've ever had the pleasure of contemplating. You know,
that's the series of books that Peter Gomes quoted somebody, maybe Barth, summarizing. Somebody said, could you boil it down, Professor Barth? And he said, yes, I can. He said,
Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells
me
so.
Right. Basically, and Bart himself, right, would have just said, Jesus Christ. You know, I mean, that's because that, I mean, that, and that's very, I mean, that's where it gets, that's where it's interesting and where your true matters of faith and all this sort of stuff really boil down to, I mean, the fact that, you know, Bart just unabashedly, you know, this is not the proof for all of this is not historically derivable. You know, this is at a certain point, it just, I mean, that faith is, you know, it's you know it by revelation, you know, which is always that's the point, you know, where you sort of give yourself over. And it's just very interesting to just contemplate that, you know, just the idea of the Bible is this kind of normative text, and reading the Bible itself is just a, you know, the model for narrative economy and concision and depth and dimension. It's just very beautiful. And particularly going back to Tyndale, you know, his translations of the Bible are where modern literary English was aborned. You know, that's, you know, a lot of people say, you know, Shakespeare wouldn't have the King James Bible. The King James Bible came out, you know, the same year, the last of Shakespeare's plays came out. So Shakespeare would have been reading the Geneva Bible, you know, which is all Tyndale's translations. And then just the English there is just so beautiful. It's just mind-boggling, you know.
Paul Harding, come back to earth, so to speak, with this novel, which is so full of stuff. The author of this book, Tinkers, knows a lot about epilepsy. One of the most riveting scenes in this whole story is of the boy, George Washington Crosby, having his hand bitten by his father, Howard, in a seizure. We won't do all of that, but the author of this book also knows clocks like crazy. Would you read a scene where George, after a career as a teacher, becomes a clock repair guy?
Sure. George bought a broken clock at a tag sale. The owner gave him a reprint of an 18th century repair manual for free. He began to poke around the guts of old clocks. As a machinist, he knew gear ratios, pistons, pinions, physics, the strength of materials. As a Yankee in North Shore horse country, he knew where the old money lay, dozing, dreaming of wood mills and slate quarries, ticker tape and fox hunts. He found that bankers paid well to keep their bulky heirlooms telling time. He could replace the worn tooth on a strike wheel by hand. Lay the clock down. Unscrew the screws. Maybe just pull them from the cedar or walnut case, the threads long since turned to wood dust, dusted from mantles. Lift off the back of the clock like the lid of a treasure chest. Bring the long-armed jeweler's lamp closer to just over your shoulder. Examine the dark brass. See the pinions gummed up with dirt and oil. Look at the blue and green and purple ripples of metal hammered, bent, torched. Poke your finger into the clock. Fiddle the escape wheel. Every part perfectly named. Escape, the end of the machine, the place where the energy leaks out, breaks free, beats time. Stick your nose closer. The metal smells tannic. Read the names etched onto the works. Ezra Bloxham, 1794, George E. Tiggs, 1832, Thomas Flatchbart, 1912. Lift the darkened works from the case. Lower them into ammonia. Lift them out, nose burning, eyes watering, and see them shine and star through your tears. File the teeth, punch the bushings, load the springs, fix the clock, add your name.
It's exquisite, Paul. It reminds me a little bit of Michael Ondaatje and the sapper taking apart a bomb in The English Patient.
Yeah. No, I was just absolutely. I mean, The English Patient. Michael Ondaatje was and remains one of my just favorite writers. And I remember having just some of the most powerful experiences as a reader. I guess starting with, I think the first thing of his I read was Coming Through Slaughter, which was when it was sort of still. Yeah. The borderland between poetry and prose, which I'm certainly always interested in that, the boundaries where
Coming one, Through Slaughter, that's Buddy Bolden?
Buddy Bolden, right. And then the other one, In the Skin of a Lion, I remember just being so knocked out by. And then the English Patient, that same sort of thing.
What's your process of learning something like, you know, horology, clocksmanship?
Well, in that particular case, my maternal grandfather was the clock guy for the North Shore for many years. And so being a broke musician for many of those years, he took pity on me and let me apprentice with him. Yeah, and so I sort of, you know, he'd sort of, you know, plunk a broken clock down in front of me and he'd say, take it apart and figure out what's wrong with it. And so I just spent a lot of time having to, you know, sort of take clocks apart and memorize how to put them back together again and all that sort of stuff. So in the book, there's this, you know, there's this wholly fictional clock repair manual that that is, you know, based on my own experience of, you know, almost having a clock put back together and then more or less falling apart and flying all over the floor and you know, never being able to find the right pieces to the clock. And
it's stunning how many scenes and places and moods and colors there are in a book that's not 200 pages long. There are many places also where I just burst out laughing. Two scenes in particular, and I wonder if you'd read them. These two wonderful women in completely different times and places that minister to these old men. There's a woman named Nikki who takes care of George, cleans him up.
Right.
As he's dying. It's also that wonderful scene where Howard's second wife is going home to Pittsburgh, and he says this is his moment to go see his son up there in Massachusetts. And he borrows somebody's car, and then there's your wonderful description of how he teaches himself to drive.
Right. He had never driven before.
This is amazing. Give us the voice of that wonderful woman, Nikki, who intervenes to clean up George as he's ready to go.
Sure. 72 hours before George died, Nikki Bocecchi, an old acquaintance from the Unitarian Church, showed up in a red Alfa Romeo convertible and flowing scarves. She took off her large sunglasses and kissed George's wife on each cheek. When she saw George in his bed, she said, "Oh, George, you handsome thing." She kissed him on the forehead and her lips left a livid lipstick print. George did not recognize her, but made a silly face like a cartoon character. "And who's this beautiful lady?" he said, which was just the right thing to say, even though he said it not only to be charming, but also because he did not actually know. Nikki put a hand on his shoulder, called him an incurable gentleman, and blushed. Nikki was an old woman who dressed like an aging former starlet whose most dramatic and final role was that of the aging former starlet persevering under the tyranny of time. She was, in fact, a nurse. Once she had chatted with George, who never remembered who she was, and his wife, she shooed the exhausted family from the room. "I have 3 hours before my shift, and I can't think of a nicer way to spend it than taking care of this sweetie pie. May I have a razor and a towel and some hot water? It isn't right that George doesn't have a good shave. He always dressed so smartly. He always looked so dapper." When the family returned 2 hours later from their naps and furtive cigarettes and whispered arguments in the side yard, Nikki was sitting next to George, reading a glossy magazine called International Luxury Properties and chewing a stick of sugarless gum. George lay asleep beneath a white sheet with only his head visible. His face was clean and smooth, his hair trimmed and combed. He wore his glasses. He looked as if he had fallen asleep in a barber's chair. When the family said what a lovely job she had done, Nikki said, "Oh, yes, yes. Well, you know, all we have is our looks."
What's going on there with these generous, kind, sort of terminally sexy women?
I don't know. I never thought of it that way. She's sort of solicitous of him in a way that I guess his father's second wife is solicitous of him in a way that his mother never was, I guess. There's a sort of, and I guess it's sort of it's connected with sort of how the plot turns, what little of the plot there is in the book, in sort of having faith that your spouse is taking care of you and interpreting their actions, her actions, their actions towards you in a way that is basically, you know, you interpret it as benign, and then you find out that it's actually not. And so that idea of just being cared for and tended to, you know, the sort of kindness and the gentleness.
Where do these women come from, so to speak?
I honestly
metaphysically.
Don't know. Metaphysically, it, you know, is, yeah. So these sort of benign precipitations out of the universe, I guess, you know. It's I don't know, maybe because that sort of kindness is always delightful to see, as it is surprising, I think, too, you know, that people are that kind to one another is always astonishing and, you know, and heartening, I think.
And they are.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think that scene too with her coming in, you know, she's a nurse, so she knows how to do this, and that that scene sort of follows on other passages in the book where the family sort of is struggles with this idea of the suddenly, you know, this mortal coil, you know, of you know, your father, your grandfather, that kind of blunt fact of the human body that can't take care of itself, and suddenly you have to take care of it. And they find it very difficult to, you know, sort of be equal to the task of doing that. There's so many emotions and such that just overwhelm them. And so to have this woman, she's sort of a angel, you know.
Absolutely.
She sort of swoops down and sort of lends the balm to everybody, you know.
Give us a little of that tenderness, Paul, between Howard and his second wife. She's off to Pittsburgh, and he sees an opening.
Right, okay. Two things happened in 1953. The new interstate highway opened, and Howard's second wife's mother fell sick in Pittsburgh. Megan told him he could not go with her to Pittsburgh. Mother was the strictest of Catholics, and if she ever found out that her daughter was married to the son of a Methodist minister, any chance she had of recovering from her illness would vanish. Mother would die with her mouth full of curses mingled with my name, she said. This meant he had to spend Christmas alone. Megan baked a banana cream pie and a meatloaf. He walked her to the bus station and helped her onto the 4:30 to Pittsburgh and all points between. She talked the entire time. She opened the bus window to tell him to take the vanilla ice cream out of the freezer 15 minutes before he had it with the pie, that made it soft just like he liked it, and said, I love you. He said, I'll be fine, still baffled that she had a mother in Pittsburgh. 25 years she had a mother in Pittsburgh. 5 months before, the interstate highway had been finished. It ran in one long line up the eastern seaboard. Immigrants, hobos, manual laborers pounded, carved, blasted, and peeled the earth open through forests, rivers, and gorges, mountains, and swamps, then lined the path with good clean gravel, filled it with piping hot blacktop, rolled it smooth, let it set to cool, and painted a line down the middle. These new superhighways had numbers for names. On the day before Christmas, he put a cold meatloaf sandwich and 6 bottles of cola in a paper bag along with his dop kit and called his friend from the A&P, Jimmy Dreesus. He asked Jimmy if he could borrow his car, an old Ford sedan. Jimmy said, sure, sure. The in-laws are coming here this year. Sure you can, pal. He took a bus to Jimmy Dreesus's house in the Greek part of town. Jimmy was replacing bulbs on strings of lights he had threaded around the iron handrails of the steps to his apartment. Jimmy offered him a drink. He said, no, thanks, Jimmy, no. Jimmy offered him some food to take back home. He said, thank you, Jimmy, thank you and your wife. Jimmy gave him the keys and a plate of lamb and said, easy on the clutch, pal. He nodded and pressed the clutch pedal and let the car roll out of the driveway, running in neutral. He shifted the car into first gear and let out the clutch as he pushed the gas pedal. Gears whirred, meshed, and then jammed. The car lunged and stalled. Jimmy Dreesus looked from his stairs, a colored Christmas bulb in each hand, and yelled, what have you been drinking, pal? And laughed. Howard waved, got the car into gear, and crept away at 5 miles an hour until he reached the corner, drove over it, turned, and stalled again, this time out of Jimmy Dreesus's sight. He spent 4 hours lurching through the streets of Philadelphia on Christmas Eve, teaching himself to drive. At 9 o'clock in the evening, as a light snow started to fall, he drove Jimmy Dreesus's Ford onto the highway heading north.
Beautiful. Paul Harding, where is the rock drummer in all this work? What's the connection?
I don't know. You know, the people ask me. I always say that the difference between being a rock drummer and writing, the differences are superficial and they're the obvious ones. You know, one, you're playing with a couple of other people on stage and you're doing it at, you know, ungodly volume. You know, I mean, I'm clinically half deaf and I have tinnitus. I hear ringing in talk radio in my ears all the time. But writing scratches the same itch. You know, I always think of, you know, and this is always a very, you know, sort of subjective kind of experience of, you know, creating art or whatever. But I always think of myself as sort of, the act of creation as being that I'm sort of just an amanuensis, you know, I'm just taking dictation. So to me, it's just circumstantial whether or not, you know, when I pick up the drumsticks, I just start translating what I hear. And if I don't have the drumsticks, I just move over to the keyboard and I just start doing the same thing. So it's sort of like channeling. I think of it as channeling. And so to that extent, you know, you just translate what you hear. And one is with rhythm and timekeeping and you know, drum beats and all that sort of stuff. And the other is with language. But having been a drummer, I write by ear. I write by rhythm. You know, I just think of the rhythm of the sentence, and there's a certain, you know, when you think of, you know, the number of beats in a sentence, in a phrase, that sort of thing, in longer passages, all that sort of stuff. So there is a kind of arranging, you know, there's a sort of the process of arranging is the same. I'm certainly, because of all these multi-generational sort of things going on, I'm just fascinated by the experience of time, of being in time and all these characters sort of thinking about time and all that. And, you know, as the drummer, that's what you do. You are the timekeeper. And so one of the things that I always loved as a drummer was the way that you can manage time within whatever the given time signature of a song is. And so you can foreshorten it. You can double it. You can halve it. You can, you know, you can bring certain parts of the song. You can foreground them or background them or put them in the middle ground, depending on how you divide time up. You know, you can futz around with all sorts of different signatures, and X number of beats will go. You know, you play a certain time signature within another time signature, and you land back on the, you know. So you can do all that sort of stuff, and that's what I think of doing when you're, it's all narrative. I mean, narrative is all about time, right, you know. And so that's what you're doing with the writing, too.
Totally fascinating. I didn't know what you played. But the writer in you has fed on Fuentes and Ondaatje and Thoreau and Emerson. Who does the drummer feed on?
I was never one for woodshedding, you know. So maybe the guys that I like to listen to and who I admire the most are the great jazz drummers, you know. Probably the all-time favorite drummer is Elvin Jones, you know, who's the drummer for Coltrane, so the famous kind of quartet that Coltrane had. And I saw him several dozen times and had the opportunity to sit right next to him and just watch what he did with time. And I mean, I could just listen to him, you know, play his hi-hat with his foot and just you know, the way he could just tap into the depths of the universe through his drums. And that's the same thing, that it's sort of circumstantial. I mean, you just, the same thing with maybe even John Coltrane himself. At a certain point, the drums become incidental. At a certain point, the horn becomes incidental. It's sort of, you know, that's the medium through which the pure stuff is just sort of gushing out of. And
what is it about Elvin Jones that he can sort of open up eternity, and yet he's also the man who, when he sets a beat, can hold it maybe for 7 days, right, if you left him quietly in the room?
Yeah, and I think that's what all the great drummers can do. That they just have that internal clock, you know, that they can keep the time in their head. And in drumming, it's called, you know, the technical, you know, one of the skills you always work on as a drummer is not only, you know, keeping tempo and keeping time, but what they call independence, you know, which is that idea that you can be doing, you know, time X with your right hand and time Y with your left hand and time Z with your right foot, and, you know, be playing in all sorts of different time signatures as you're corralling or wrangling them all with the time that you're keeping in your head. You know, so it's this sort of, it's you know, it's this multitasking, this kind of thing. It's orchestration, you know. It's learning how to, you could think of it in the same way of, you know, like a string quartet and the different pieces and the way that you can play counterpoint with yourself, with your own different limbs and all that kind of stuff. And I think of that as the same way of arranging narrative too. You know, the way that you can just, I think of, you know, any given scene, there's all sorts of different strata, you know, in the writing. And so you can have certain things moving very quickly and nimbly in one level of the writing with their, you know, much deeper, you know, larger kind of cycles going on underneath it. And you can just work with all that kind of contrast and counterpoint. And it's the way that you actually pull depth out of things. And it's the way that you get kind of dimensionality.
This, I think, is why it's such a pleasure, Paul, to come back into this book at any point and sort of listen to what's going on, to puzzle, to hold it up to a different sort of light. It fascinates me also, Paul, that you're teaching. What do you see? What do you learn? What do you tell the generation that's even younger than you about what they're doing, what they're experiencing, what's to learn, what's to say?
I don't know. I guess the longer I teach writing, the more you find these kind of fewer and fewer sort of axiomatic things that you always want to tell your, your students. I mean, to me, the one that I really find, at least lately, that I really, really find myself constantly hammering away at is what you want to do is I think of it in terms of fiction. It probably applies to poetry as well. But what you want to do is you want to write as clearly and straightforwardly and precisely as you can about things that are truly mysterious, as opposed to writing obscurely writing obscurely about what proves to be received opinion or cliche. Once the sort of parlor trick of whatever fancy stuff you're doing with the prose is. And I think it's very counterintuitive because people are so afraid of, you know, I've got a little bit of meaning here, so I'm going to like actually kind of keep it off stage and not be straightforward about it. And that's how they want to be subtle and that's how they want to get to meaning. But really, lay all your cards on the table, you know, write everything that you do know and then you can start writing about what you don't know. You know, interrogative writing, that kind of thing.
Are you interested in what you find kids reading these days?
I'm worried about what I find people. I don't know. I mean, again, I feel like I just sound like kind of cantankerous, sort of. But that's another thing. I mean, I'm a firm believer in that as a writer, your writing can only be as good as the best stuff you've read. What I worry about is that there is at least an observable phenomenon where people only read kind of roughly what their peers are getting published, and it's kind of more of a market kind of driven thing, like they got that published, that sort of thing, or I don't know, you know, I mean, I cannot count myself a fan of Harry Potter. I just don't find it. I'm just not a fan, you know. And I've read the books, you know, I'm reading them to my I don't know, you know. It's funny, I was just invited to teach at the Ira Writers Workshop next year, and I have to teach a seminar, and the first single word that popped into my mind when I realized, I'm going to have a room full of grad students for 15 weeks was Proust. I thought, it would be a riot. Everybody would go crazy if we tried to read 3,000 or 4,000 pages of Proust. But I mean, I really feel like, you know, you've got to read your Thomas Mann, you've got to read your Proust, you've got to read your Henry James, you've got to read your Willa Cather, you've got to read your Edith Wharton and your Carlos Fuentes and just your Tolstoy and your Chekhov. I mean, you need to have an intimate familiarity with the high watermarks of your chosen art so you know what it can do. I think that's often a painful prospect for people because then it becomes even more acute. Like, you know, confronting your own limitations every day becomes more acute. You know, the sort of seeing what you're falling short of. But I don't think there's any. If you're really serious about writing, you have to know that stuff. I think eventually you do.
Can you tell them it's the privilege of their life to read Proust?
Well, that's the sort of thing that you have to say this isn't a duty, it's a pleasure. You know, that sort of thing, and sort of reverse engineer a lot of that sort of the eat it, it's good for you kind of. That's another thing too. I talk to people about, you know, this idea that, you know, reading dense, and I mean, I've run into this with Tinkers too, you know, the idea that, well, you do have to read it slowly and you won't get it the first time you read it, and that's not bad. I mean, a lot of people think that that's a liability rather than a virtue, and this idea that, look, let me suggest reasons why this might be a virtue. But you know, so this idea that it's almost punitive, you know, you read your Shakespeare is almost, you know, punitive. You know, I always point out that, you know, first of all, the point of reading a book is not to finish it. You know, that's not the main point, is not to get through it, you know. But I just always pose the rhetorical question, you know, have you listened to your favorite album once? You know, have you looked at your favorite painting once? Have you seen your favorite movie once? No, these are things that, you know, you watch The Godfather 150 times, you know, and you go hear, you know, Beethoven's Opus 132 a million times, and every time the convalescent song of Thanksgiving, you know, you burst into tears. And you know, it's just that idea of, that's another thing, which is just durability, trying to make art, you know, the real art, you know, surely part of the definition of art must be irreducibility, the fact that you can keep going back to it and it keeps precipitating more meaning and keeps generating more meaning and is always worthy of another look. You can't exhaust it. You know, the idea of writing these little blameless stories that you can read it and you get it and then you can just sort of say, okay, next, you know, this kind of production line consumption, you know, the consumer's version of stories. Oh, I read that, check, you know, as opposed to you just keep, you know, keep going back to proof because you just can't believe it. You keep going back to the Magic Mountain, you know, you return to the, you keep going back to Terra Nostra because you're haunted by it. The best art haunts you. You have to go back for another look, another listen, another read.
Paul, this is the way I feel about Tinkers. We're also Facebook friends by some strange chance. What does this new digital social web world have to do with the spreading the lightning of your book, your reputation, your new career?
Facebook, I mean, I don't know, you know, because I mean, you know, my disposition, I have to fight against being the cranky analog, you know, you kids and your Facebook and your Twitter, you know, that sort of stuff. I mean, to me, I just think, you know, it's a medium and it's perfectly fine. And it's actually nice. I mean, I've been able to network with tons of people and sort of there's that immediacy. And if I'm doing a reading, I just sort of put it up on Facebook, that kind of thing. The danger always is that, the means becomes the end, that sort of thing. And I just don't know. I'm just especially wary of sort of, you know, technology becoming the end rather than the means to anything. I mean, I'm just much more of a kind of like blood and guts sort of just go into a room and think it out for yourself kind of thing. You know, which does, I mean, I have my iPod and I love it and couldn't live without it, all that sort of stuff. But it's. I mean, it just always has to supplement the mind itself, that sort of thing. It can't take the place. So I don't know, because there's plenty of people on Facebook that you just think, oh my good, you don't do anything else but say, now I'm making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and now I'm eating that peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and now I'm, you know, recalling having eaten that peanut butter. You know, and it just becomes this sort of weird involution.
Of course, but we can leave it here. To me, the beauty of it is that inside all that wildly transforming technology is a writer of huge skill doing his thing and finding an audience and finding me, for crying out loud. It's a huge pleasure for me to find you and to talk, Paul Harding. We'll do it again, I'm sure. I hope we'll do it many times. But thank you.
Well, it was wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Sarah Archambault and Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.